You're listening to Cairo News Radio Middays.
Welcome back to Cairo News Radio Middays. Jack Stein and Spike O'Neill. Mr. Cairo has hit a home run with the team of Spike, Jack, and Chris. Thanks, guys, for the great shows. Hope you're around for a long time. Loyal listener, Judy. Well, that's a long nickname you got there, Spike. It's a crazy
nickname. My tattoo artist wanted $700 to put that on my inner arm here, from my armpit to my elbow. I said, go for it. I don't care. Damn the expense. Put that on there.
Well, you know, speaking of expenses, by the way, speaking of a man that is here out of the kindness of his heart, and a man that can't physically talk until I actually play his intro music. Trevor, go ahead and take that down for me. Just a little, go ahead and fade that out. Go ahead.
Nice, okay,
cool. There we go.
Nice
very
work.
Smooth. Very smooth. Yeah. Very good. Very good, Trevor. Now we're just going to do a little bit of this. A man who stands at approximately 6'8" with a 37-inch vertical leap. A man with biceps like you would not believe. The size of basketballs. Deltoids the size of bowling balls. A man with 8-pack abs. Chris Sullivan joins us. Wow. Unbelievable.
Well, you know, I would have been here at 12:30, but I was at the gym, and Chris will back me up on that. I mean, when you're 6'8" and you got a 37-inch vertical leap, you know, you got to keep working on that. I mean, not just talent. I mean, I got to keep working.
Yeah, you got the upkeep. You got the LeBron James diet is what we're talking about.
It's a lifetime commitment.
Not to mention all the supplements and shady things I have to take, too. That's an entirely... Oh, wait a minute. This isn't the night show, is it? Wait a minute. Hold on.
We don't
this
talk about that.
2 o'clock in the afternoon.
First rule at midday. You don't talk about that at midday.
Chris Sullivan, so you had a very interesting interview with some fine people over at the Sound Transit, talking to people, shaking them down, shoving people into lockers, saying, give me the truth. You can't handle the truth is what you were yelling at people, I heard tell. And so what do you got for us today, Chris Sullivan?
Well, yeah, matter of fact, the first thing, I had a chance to sit down with Julie Timm. She is the new CEO of Sound Transit. She's been there 6 months, almost on the dot. And, yeah, I mean, I didn't shove her into a locker, but I did tell her that her overconfidence was her weakness.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, to tell you how much I was listening last hour. No, I was a chance to sit down with her because, obviously, it's one of the biggest agencies in our region. It is in charge of tens of billions of taxpayer dollars, doesn't have the greatest track record in terms of delivering things on time and on budget. And, you know, she's 6 months in, and I've been trying to get a sit down with her for the last couple of months just to kind of ask, you know, what she's all about. You know, what's her style like? Her predecessor, Peter Rogoff, was a different kind of guy. He was an East Coast guy, and some of the people here in Washington didn't take too kindly to his kind of forward personality, so much so that he had to go to training to handle that. But again, I thought someone who was pretty effective. Wait. No, I'm not making that up.
Wait,
because
so,
the people here couldn't handle someone who was that upfront.
I went through it too. East Coast de-escalation training. I've been through it.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So because I've noticed this as well, that people on the East Coast, my father's half of the family is all East Coast. I was originally born in Connecticut, so. There is kind of an East Coast, what do you want to call it, Spike,
There's
directness?
Inbred aggression. Yeah. And it comes from limited resource and unlimited immigration. I'm telling you, it's a real thing.
So he was a little, I mean, in your face from some people's descriptions, you know, who were under him. But again, this isn't about him. I mean, he did a good job. He shepherded this program through ST2, which 54 billion dollars at the ballot box at 2016, but he ran his time, and Julie is now in charge. And, you know, 6 months in, I wanted to, you know, ask, you know, what's she all about? How, you know, what's, you know, what does she see the agency? Where are the flaws? What are you all about? And, you know, this comes after, in a couple, you know, over the last month or so, we've already seen her make decisions about increasing security, adding more fare ambassadors, going back to and making people pay for actually riding the train. So there's some things that she's actually implementing in her first 6 months. And I just want to say it was a very good, frank, 30-minute conversation where we talked about all sorts of things. And I love the fact that she is very passionate about transit because that's her job, right? She's very passionate about that. But what she's passionate about is – in addition to getting this built, because obviously we've been waiting since 1996 to get this thing built out. Think about that. But she's more of an operations person, where Peter was more of a money person. She's in the idea of, listen, we've been build for so long that we kind of were like forgetting the people who are actually writing what we're giving them. And, you know, we need to let people know that when the escalators aren't working, they're not working. Or when we're going to have a line out because we've got some maintenance, that the writers actually need to know about those kinds of things. So nice. It was very refreshing to see that the fact that the agency is now transitioning from a build only to an operations system. I mean, they're providing service and they need to do a better job communicating with the public, and she's all about that, and I thought it was very refreshing.
So what's this I hear tell about you? There was something about fiscal responsibility, and I hear tell that you stuck it to the man over the course of this conversation.
Well, no, what's interesting is, you know, Julie, she said she's fiscally responsible, and I almost fell over in my chair, because to find somebody in Seattle who might actually say that on the record in a government position who is in charge of tens of billions of taxpayer dollars,
there just
aren't many of them around. And I asked her about that, and she's like, listen, we can't afford to be Santa Claus to everybody. And that's a quote. And Sound Transit has had a history of building maybe more than they should have in terms of the amenities, instead of just laying track and getting this thing built. And that was also very refreshing, the fact to find out here's a person who's really interested in getting the taxpayers what they have paid for and not overburdening, and, you know, getting it done and watching the dollars and cents, and does X make sense over Y? And what was also really refreshing about her is that I didn't get standard 15-second talking point answers that we're used to from people in government in our region. She was very thoughtful and took long times explaining herself, and you could feel the empathy and the emotion of her talking, and I really appreciated that too. It was a good conversation with someone that we need to hold accountable for the job that she now has.
So we read a story from the Seattle Times. When was this? I think it was last week, Spike, about how people are avoiding Sound Transit altogether because of the fentanyl and the
ridership is down because of on train drug use.
Right. And so my thought was, Chris Sullivan being our traffic god, my thought is, if you want to improve ridership, one of the things you have to do is you have to make it much more kid friendly. Because if people don't see kids, and if parents don't feel safe with their kids on transit, it's like, you know, that's kind of the beginning of the end of it, right? I mean, you can't, if people don't feel safe in general, they're not going to use it. So
yeah, well, she told me, she was like, listen, we've got to clean the trains. Yeah. I know that. We've got to make them safe. She's like, people are not going to ride the train if there is human feces on the train.
Yeah.
And I'm like, she's like, yeah, I'm aware of that. And we're trying to fix that with, you know, the ambassador program, getting more people on there, more fare enforcement, having more visibility on they're hiring attendants on a pilot project at two of the bigger stations, Northgate and the tunnel, to try to have more visible things there. And so she understands from the rider perspective, I think, what needs to be done to change the trajectory here and to get people back on board and to maybe clear some of the areas from those that have somewhat taken over the mass transit system and that have kept other people away. Now, what will help? And again, this is something we didn't discuss, but I mean, what starts on Thursday, right? What starts on Thursday? A very highly anticipated Mariner season. Light rail drops tons of people at the Mariners.
Okay.
And if we could see ridership being boosted by people who feel safe in larger numbers with kids going through what could be a very well-used light rail season with the Mariners, maybe that's an impetus that they can use and use positivity and uses there to try to change the direction or change the public perception or change the public's lack of trust in this agency. So we'll see. But I think there's an opportunity there going into a very high point of what I think will be ridership, because it is convenient to park at Angle Lake or park at the airport station there at Interurban or park at Northgate and catch the train down there and not have to worry about parking, because it drops you right there. But people got to be feel safe. I get it. They're not going to ride it if they don't. They're not going to put their kids on it if they don't. And I think she's keenly aware of that, and she's started to make some changes.
Well, now that you and Director Tim or Julie are on a first-name basis, Chris, I think it's time for you to deliver some messages for the citizens of Seattle to Sound Transit.
Yeah, Chris. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I tried.
Do me a favor. Tell Julie, because you guys are in such a close, and I'm glad that you're close with the administrator. This is the inside track to getting things done.
Yeah.
This new study that is being begun by the Washington State University Department of Environment and Health Sciences, which is probably the best in the world, and Professor Marissa Baker, who is leading this study, they're doing the first of its kind examination of narcotic fumes within transit vehicles to find out their effect on transit workers and transit riders. They have handheld air monitors and concealed behind wall air monitors to monitor the secondhand smoke of narcotics being smoked on buses.
Yeah, isn't that really interesting? I mean, that's where we've come to. But yeah, I'm interested to find out the study on this and what we find, because they're trying to figure out how the air circulates inside. You know, they're putting one on a couple on buses and one on at least one of the light rail trains, and to find out how the air circulates in there. So, like, for instance, I think most people are familiar with, you know, a cigarette smoke. We'll just use that
as, sure.
You know, where does it go? How does it circulate? Is there secondhand components? Could it get to the driver and impair an operator, right? Nobody wants that. I mean, you could certainly smell it when it's being used. I mean, we had the train or the bus shut down a couple weeks ago where the fumes were somewhat overbearing. The operator was like, whoa, they had to, you know, they shut it down. So, yeah, it's interesting to find out what, because there isn't a lot known about this, how it circulates, how it impacts you. Secondhand, you know, fentanyl smoke versus secondhand marijuana smoke versus secondhand. So it's interesting, but I think it's good that they're trying this.
No, Chris, you're missing my point here. I'm sorry, Sally, you're killing me here.
sorry.
No, that's okay. Tell your friend Julie that you've got this. Tell your friend Julie that you've got this irrational, short-triggered friend who's on the radio with you that thinks instead of maybe determining how much effect that narcotic smoking has on the air quality of our buses and trains, how about we just don't smoke any fentanyl or crack or marijuana on buses and trains?
Baby steps.
Yeah. Oh,
no. Good point. No. Good point.
Killing me.
I have a really good idea, Chris, and this is something I want you to share with our new friend Julie, since we're all so close.
Don't assume. Sully's
well,
close.
I mean, a friend of Chris Sullivan's is a friend of mine. You know, let's just so
truer words were never spoken.
This is my idea, and I've had this idea for quite some time. Now, the original inception of this idea was for people who talk in movie theaters. Just so you guys know. But I'm gonna transfer it over to Sound Transit. You get an elderly British woman who's dressed in a gray kind of monastery robe, like a nun almost.
Okay.
And she has a huge bell that she dings, right? It goes, ding! Uh-huh. It's really loud, and she carries it around. And if you are misbehaving on light rail, any kind of public transit, she comes up to you and she stands next to you and she goes, shame. And then she hits the bell. Ding. And then she goes, shame. And then she goes, ding. And she does that until you get off or you leave.
Oh, my God.
And everybody applauds whenever it happens. Because I think this is the way of the future. Because if you're on drugs, the last thing that you want is an overbearing British lady, elderly, by the way, shaming you. And then the second thing you don't want is a bell going off right by your head. This is the way of the future. We're taking old technology and we're refurbishing it and we're making it modern.
Attention, Sound Transit riders. We're approaching King's Station. We're approaching Kingsgate Station and King's Landing.
Exactly.
Wish I knew my Game of Thrones reference better.
No, that's
a shame lady would be great on
right,
a train.
A shame lady. And oh. And we pay her in gold coins. We pay her in doubloons. That's
I'm
market.
Somehow envisioning the older lady from Princess Bride.
That
booing the princess. That's what we're looking at, right there. Boo! Right, that's what you're looking for.
A lot of these, and I've been saying this for some time, and I feel like I have a lot of leeway to say it as someone who did a lot of drugs for a lot of years. A lot of these people need to be shamed. I have a tremendous amount of empathy for people who are addicted to drugs. But at the same time, if you're doing drugs near kids or by other people who are just trying to live their lives, you deserve to have a British woman ring a bell in your face and say shame over and over again.
I think you got to have the bell. I think the bell makes it magic. Bell makes it theater. Yeah.
Right, right. And that way everybody wins because everybody appreciates the shame lady. She gets to make her gold doubloons so she can buy a fine fat goose, and we all we get public transit that's clean, right? Now, I mean, this is the way of the future, man.
Chris, I'm being facetious. I really am. But when we do studies about how smoking narcotics on trains affects the air quality of our trains, as opposed to taking that money and maybe kicking drug users off of trains, it just seems like such a misspent priority, you know?
And yeah. I get you there, Spike, but the issue then, we go back into the original, go back to the survey that, you know, started going during the start of the pandemic, that people don't want heavy-handed enforcement of people misbehaving on mass transit.
And the
fact that it was being somewhat heavy-handed in relation to, you know, your ethnicity. Some issues there that go along with that. But your point is well taken. Yes, if you're doing drugs on a public piece of transportation, you should be kicked off. Yeah, you're right. There's no doubt about that. But it's not that easy, as we've come to find out in Seattle, to do that.
Yeah. A really smart lady I know who works somewhere close to this newsroom, I'm going to say which desk, said, what if we just made them, you know, pay the fare, enforced fares?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because if you keep off folks who can't afford to ride the train, it won't be a free, safe, clean, dry place to smoke.
True. But, you know, there are lots of dangling tentacles from that. And that's why we haven't seen it get any better. Our city is very tolerant when it comes to these things. And I think we're all seeing the result of that, not just in when it comes to mass transit. So it's a very difficult thing, though it is most likely the prudent thing, Spike, to do what you're saying. It would make the system work. But again, this is a city that doesn't have turnstiles, right?
Yeah.
So, but your point is well taken.
Chris Sullivan, you're a hero. You're a man among men.
I don't know about a hero.
He's a man above men.
We appreciate everything that you do for us, my friend. Truly just a natural when it comes to being a traffic god. We'll take a really quick break, by the way, as I kill your outro music because we're right up against the clock. When we get back, by the way, Chris, we're going to be talking about why people are such awful drivers. And I'm going to tell people all about that one time that you and I went driving around downtown and you were saying things that I dare not repeat on the radio. That's what I'm going to do.
Sweet.
Thanks again, Chris. We'll be right back right after this. All right, welcome back. A new poll has found that Northwest drivers are less courteous and more aggressive when compared to previous years, Spike. And I contribute most of that to you, my friend. I think this is mostly your fault, right?
Yes. No, I can be the most passive and congenial and generous driver on the face of the earth. And I have had my moments. I have had my moments of road rage, and I will brake check an idiot faster than you can say Rumpelstiltskin. But I tend to be one of the kinder drivers. The way this study was conducted, they asked drivers in both Portland and Seattle, how many kind gestures a month do you witness while driving? No.
Kind.
How many?
Really?
That's how bad it is. Do you see at least 5 kind gestures a month while driving?
Like the courtesy wave, like when you lay out, because I do the passive aggressive kind of like a waiter where I fan my arm open. You know what I mean? So go. That's what I like to do.
Well, no, a courtesy wave, or when someone lets you in and you wave a thank you to them, or even letting someone in.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's how bad it is. Not how many aggressive moves have you seen last month? Have you seen at least 5 kind gestures in the last month? And that number is dropping from 2018 to 2013. A 12% drop in Portland in the witnessing of kind gestures. In Seattle, it's a 13% drop in kind gestures seen per month.
The problem with road rage is that people view their car as an extension of themselves. And so I think that's why people get this animalistic, yo, bro, kind of approach when somebody cuts them off or they don't merge fast enough. And so there's kind of a psychological it's like people view it as an extension of their own body. And so rather than just saying, well, some people drive in incorrect ways, people take it as this person just cut in front of me in the lunch line, right? Or this person just pushed me out of the elevator or whatever. So
rude, bordering on assault.
Right.
Yeah. We talked before with Sally a little bit about how East Coast aggression is a natural way of living in a very competitive environment that is the East Coast. And a lot of places like New York, Boston, D.C., all the way to Chicago, you name it. L.A. has very similar traits. When there are a lot of people and limited resources and limited space availability, people tend to be more competitive, i.e. more aggressive.
Yeah. Did I ever say about my buddy Mac? My buddy Mac had the worst road rage of anybody I've ever met in my life.
No.
Okay, so Mac had a little Jetta, little Volkswagen Jetta, but it was all souped up.
Okay.
And Mac kind of, he fancied himself as like an extreme driver type kind of guy, even though he wasn't. The fact that he had a stick shift was, you know, in his mind made him basically like Ryan Gosling in Drive. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Like
I do. He's Baby Driver.
He thinks he's Baby Driver. Yeah. So, but Mac had the worst road rage out of anybody that I ever met. And I will encapsulate it in this one story. So Mac and I are driving along and we would use his ashtray in his car to do coke in. I know this is a bad way to start a story, but that we would get all coked up while Mac was driving because we were idiots. I know it's really bad.
No. We almost made it through the whole show hitting a moment of Jack Stein bingo. But here we are at 2:37 in the afternoon.
Right. So he has this ashtray that is detachable. It's a plastic ashtray and we would dump the drugs into it and then we would do the drugs out of the ashtray. Super gross. So anyway, we're driving along and we're chatting and a woman fails to merge fast enough for Mac and she merges in front of him and he had to brake and this made him very mad. So he speeds up to her speed. We are going approximately 65 miles per hour. He rolls down my window. So all of the coke goes up into the air, like poof, just immediately all over the place. He's so enraged, he doesn't notice.
Oh.
And he starts screaming past me. I'm in the passenger seat, past me at this poor woman. And I will never forget this poor woman. She's got a redheaded woman just minding her own business, you know, listening to "When the Rain Falls Down and Wash Away." She's, you know, listening to a little Hillary Duff. And Mac is just screaming at this woman, "Roll down your window! Roll down your window! Roll, merge faster!" He's just screaming at this woman, pointing at her. And keep in mind, he's not looking in front of him. He's looking at the woman, and we're going 65.
God.
Right. And so he keeps this up. I don't want to oversell it, but for about 15 seconds of not looking at the road in front, just screaming at this poor woman who is so terrified at this point in time, she takes the exit. That wasn't her exit. I can guarantee you. She takes the exit. And so Mac then rolls up the window and starts talking to me again as if nothing has occurred. As if the last 15 seconds where both of our lives and that poor lady's life was at risk did not occur.
As the cloud of secondary cocaine begins to settle amongst the you and the kids.
Right,
of the car.
Exactly. So we wasted probably $20 to $40 worth of cocaine. And then I had to explain to Mac that his action hath resulted in us having to turn around and go back to said dealer's house. So
oh my God.
That's what Jack Stein was doing when he was 22 years old. But thankfully not anymore, right?
I am so glad you lived through your past to be
me
here
too.
With us.
Me too.
On a daily basis from 12 to 3.
Nothing but great stories coming out of those years. But the thing that always got me about Mac, and I think this is true for most people, is that outside of him driving, he was the nicest guy. He was such a sweetheart of a guy, opening doors for little ladies, offering, to help people. He was such a sweet and caring guy. The second that he put his keys in the ignition of that Jetta, he turned into like Macho Man Savage. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like he was like, what's the guy's name? Was it Jake the Snake?
I don't know. Is that the driver, the car, the mongoose and snake? Those two?
No.
The wrestler.
Okay, yeah. But he just turned into the worst human being on God's green earth. And I could never really understand it until I realized that he viewed the car as an extension of himself and could not psychologically separate that from someone actively insulting him.
Well, I think there's something to that hypothesis that people do become an extension of what they drive, because people pick cars based on their personality. They often do that. They want to be viewed and judged and by their car, by what they drive. It's a status symbol. It's an extension of ourselves. I think it's got a lot more to do with, though, the influx of foreigners to Seattle. And to the Northwest, because I'm serious.
you don't mean foreigners.
I mean New Yorkers, Philadelphians, okay. LA, you name it, Chicagoans, Minnesotans, wherever they're from,
right.
Baltimoreans like myself.
Yeah.
We have this aggressive style of how we drive. And Seattle, we're talking about an increase in road rage and aggressive driving in Portland and Seattle, mostly Seattle. But it's when people move here to take jobs in high tech here and bring their Boston driving techniques or their LA driving techniques up here.
Yeah.
And infiltrate our no after you mentality. The home of the 35-minute four-way stop, Seattle, Washington. that's who we were, but that's not who we are, because the city itself is not who we were. Now it's who we are.
Yeah.
As a collective community from people from all over the country.
I think that's a fair way to put it. And I would also just encourage people that you're going to get where you're going. And if you're just a little bit polite on the roadways, it'll save you a lot of stress throughout the day.
Amen. Do you need that 8 seconds that badly?
Right. Yeah, I really try to be as nice as I can to people on the roadways, because you never know when someone's just right on the edge and they might lose it. All right, speaking of right on the edge, when we get back, we're going to go over hot takes and constructive criticisms and wrap all this up when we get back right after this. All right. Hot takes, constructive criticism. Really quick, Spike, before we get to the other ones, there's an argument here that is an interesting argument, but it's also an incorrect way to argue. And I would like to try to be kind to our friend Chris for his thoughts. So we're talking about the shooter in Nashville, and we were talking about the different takes that people had on it, the people on the left, people on the right, that kind of thing. And Chris, and I was basically, the argument that I was trying to make is that the rhetoric that I'm hearing from both sides is really bad, and it's really toxic, and I don't like it, and it makes me sad. And so Chris says that the rhetoric on the right has only met the rhetoric on the left, because the left now has LGBTQ flags in kindergarten classrooms. The left is not only telling you not to discriminate against people, they're actually telling you to celebrate and hold up trans people above everyone else. So when you're saying they in the context of this argument, I have no idea who you're talking about, because I have never met a quote unquote leftist who believes in the redistribution of wealth, who also says that we should hold up trans people above everybody else. I've never heard anybody make that argument before, that trans people should have more rights than everybody else. So this is a vagary in your argument. But then also, Chris, when you say the rhetoric on the right has only met the rhetoric on the left because the left now has LGBTQ flags in kindergarten classrooms, that's a non sequitur. That doesn't make any sense. So the implication being is that if there weren't pride flags in kindergarten classrooms, that people on the right would be nicer to trans people? It does not follow. It doesn't make any sense. Because I can guarantee you, Chris, that if there weren't LGBTQ flags in kindergarten classrooms, there would still be people on the right who think that gayness should be criminalized and that transness should be criminalized, right? I mean, if we're just looking at this from reality, I don't think I could go to anybody on the fundamentalist far Christian right and say, hey, you guys, there's no more pride flags in kindergarten classrooms. You guys can be nice to gay people now, and they can get married too, right? And they would go, yeah, absolutely, now that the flags aren't in classrooms. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't follow. It's a non sequitur. You got to reform that argument, my friend, so that you can have it make a little bit more sense when you're trying to make your point. Is that fair, Spike?
I think it's a fair way to look at that. And I welcome Chris to come back tomorrow.
Yeah, try again, buddy.
We'd love to have the discussion with you. And as to the First Amendment, Ed said to me, Spike, why do you encourage left ideologies if you really believe in the First Amendment? Because you're advocating for those people on the left to squash people on the right.
I've never heard you say that one time, Spike. I've been working with you now for about 6 weeks. Never heard you say that one time.
Well, as far as the left squashing people on the right, I don't believe it's Democratic-led state legislations or Democratic governors that are trying to ban books or squash free speech.
Yeah.
Well, you know, are there some? Okay, those might be an outlier, but I think maybe for the vast majority, isn't it a conservative viewpoint that wants to say David is pornography and books about gay penguins is harming their kids?
Yes, correct. That would be correct. Okay. On the left, it's much more about kind of racial insensitivity. So, for example, in San Francisco, the kids can't read Native Son, which used to be required reading in the state of California, because they deem it to be racially insensitive, because it is a difficult read. But
it happens
on both sides. What happens is that people do this no true Scotsman thing where they're like, no conservative would really want to ban books. And then all of a sudden you see that there's book banning. And then on the left, they say leftists don't want to squash free speech. And then they campaign Netflix to cancel Dave Chappelle because he said some tired and old tropes about trans people.
That's fair enough. We can find outlying examples. Absolutely.
Mike had a really good question. Mike says, what law would either of you pass that would have stopped the shooting? I'm not mocking you. I'm asking you a real question, which is, I really appreciate the clarification, Mike, because most people think that that's some kind of a dig. Says, tell me which law you would pass that would have stopped that horrific tragedy. Very easy answer, Mike, as a matter of fact. I would have had a police officer at that school. I think that that would have been great at all times, on staff, on campus, the entirety of the time. I think that would have probably made the shooter think twice about going to that particular facility.
And I would counter that with, had the security forces in Uvalde been facing handguns as opposed to military grade weaponry, they may have been faster to engage that shooter.
Yeah, we're gonna have to disagree, but
it's not an easy needle to thread. There's your bingo for the day, right there.
Right there, you go.
Needle threads.
Mike, I hope that answers your question. You have my response, and then Spike's response to that. So Spike wants no AR-15s, and Jack Stein wants cops in schools. So I hope that answers that for you. We were talking about the anchor woman who was suspended for using the Snoop Dogg phrase. And what is this? Cliff says. This
and before we do, though,
yeah,
Bambi, bulletproof Benning.
Yes, yeah. Very true. Yeah, from WLBT in Mississippi.
I love her.
So Cliff says, there's power in victimhood, money, attention, etc. As long as that power is reinforced, people will continue to actively gravitate towards it. I find it fascinating, Cliff, that the thing that you got out of that story is that I don't understand that this is what you got out of that story. Like, I really don't. This is bizarre to me. This is some NPC behavior. This is some bot behavior right here, Cliff. This is not contributing to the conversation. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Right?
I'm not sure who's the victim in the story.
Who's the victim?
Is it Bambi?
Right. Because Bambi is the victim, right? Bambi is the one who was suspended, and we want her to have her job back. The station will likely lose money canceling Bambi or Barbie because they have to then pay her out for the rest of her.
Oh, it's Barbie, it's not Bambi. Sorry, yeah. Right? Sorry.
They have to pay her out for the rest of her contract. They're getting negative attention. So none of this makes sense, Cliff. Respectfully, my friend, none of this. Every article that I have read about this poor woman being suspended has been people saying that she should get her job back. So when you say that power is being reinforced, it's actually not. So a good try, Cliff, but you might want to try again next time.
Come on back tomorrow, buddy. Love to have you back.
And then cashless businesses, 253 says, unbanked folks is a real thing, Jack. You had help. Folks told you what to do. A lot don't have that kind of support. The big issue is also in the LGBTQAS community too. Okay, well, that's an interesting argument. We'll have to analyze that at a different time. Stick around. Coming up next, John Curley is going to come on, and he's going to tell a story, true story, Spike, about how one time he got into an arm wrestling match with Morton Downey Jr. and won. And you're going to want to hear all about that story coming up at 3 o'clock. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll see you guys then. Bye.